Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. David Orr has been at that leading edge for decades now. Bill
bleeding
Russell?
Edge, I think it's bleeding edge,
well,
isn't it?
Well, sometimes...
one edge is a two-edged sword.
I say that over decades part because none of these things are abstractions to you. We have lived in the American South for 30 years. You lived in the American South for 15 or 20 years. Well, over the last 30 years, a number
years,
of times, Experiencing what happens when it gets really hot for a really long time is not trivial. I vividly remember, I think it was 1980, when we were living in Alabama, and there that summer there was a stretch when for, I don't remember, it was 3 or 4 weeks, no day did it get cooler than 100 degrees, and no night did it get cooler than the high 90s. Mm-hmm. And after a month of that, your idea of climate change has been radically altered, right?
Well, summer 1980, I was in Arkansas, and that was the hottest, driest summer. I think it still holds the record in Arkansas history. And Mount St. Helens erupted in, I think it was early June, when the cloud of ash crossed over Arkansas. That was the last measurable rainfall we had until late October. 59 out of 60 days, it went over 100 degrees. So that was the new benchmark for me. That was hot.
And it was no fun.
No.
Well, and this goes to a serious concern in the United States, which is a lot of people live next to the ocean. It's a nice place to live. a lot of people, fewer, but many live in the Midwest, in the interior of the country, and the predictions are very hard because we're dealing with extraordinarily complex systems, nonlinear feedback, lots of different attributes. However, the sea level is rising, and the sea level, if certainly the more current estimates are that we are going to have to depopulate large sections of our coastal areas. Florida, I think, will be an archipelago soon. But large, New York City, San Francisco less, but around the edges, but a tremendous number of people are going to have to be moved at a time when we have serious resource constraints. And then you start looking at the political issues around that, the economic issues
around
that.
And we're the rich country.
The ethical issues around that. No, it's not even to talk about Bangladesh, which is disappearing before our eyes, or actually not before our eyes, because we don't talk about it, we don't show it. But it seems to me that the reality of that is one would think that by now people would begin to be paying attention, and yet, as you say, they don't seem to be paying attention. Why is that?
Next question.
Let me filibuster for a moment. We all try to do too much, and I found years ago that anything that was below number 3 on my to-do list just didn't get done. And I think a lot of people, the people that, as you say, are on your side of the table, our side of the table, we know it's a problem, it's number 4 on the list. And I'm dealing with, number 1's a real, and number 2, and number 3, and I'll get to 4 tomorrow, or next week, or whatever.
Sure.
And we're
going
to next week ourselves out of existence, literally.
there's no good short answer to the question. But in some ways, again, evolution wired us not to be very effective in these kinds of cases. We are really good if it's quick, hairy, and mean.
And we'll bite you.
And we are part of the food chain. Yeah, we're not so good if it's slow, kind of erosive, distant in time. We're just not good. We have to think our way through this. And what we hear on this side of the chasm, public discourse here, and this side is the science. And what the science says is that for just the United States, the Southwest will become largely uninhabitable. The 4 million people in Phoenix won't have water, and it's going to be too hot to live there. The Midwest will be part, as all mid-continent areas will be, apparently, of a long-term drying process. They will desiccate, and there are studies that show that we won't be able to grow wheat in the wheat belt in the United States.
Australia is a very good example of that right now.
It's happening right now.
And then the Southeast, where you've been living for years and where I lived for a long time, the Southeast becomes hotter and drier, and ecosystems shift. You change the hydrology and rainfall, and lots of other things change. Storms get bigger. So rainfall may or may not stay the same, but rainfall events get bigger, and we've seen that trend through the whole 20th century and now in the 21st century. And so,
which means floods.
Floods, yeah. Runoff is much faster, diseases change, sea levels rise.
Strips the topsoil.
And what we do with this, and now what we do in a college, we put this into courses in hydrology over here and atmospheric physics over here, and so it's kind of like watching fireflies of a summer night. You see, there's a little light here, a little light here, and now we have to connect dots. And the only effective response is to understand how these things connect. And then we know better than we act. All of us do. And so even if I know that that's the truth, it is still very difficult to summon the wherewithal to act. And so now we have to, and we don't have much time. So now we have to act.
And that not much time is within months and years, not decades and centuries.
Well, you know, the time thing, Paula, is interesting, because if you ask James Lovelock, arguably the best independent scientist in the world, who's now 90, James Lovelock has written two books, his last one subtitled A Final Warning. And basically, Lovelock believes it's all over, that we've now tripped Gaia into a whole different phase, and that we'll see this warming trend, and then he argues, he believes from his own data, that there'll be a cooling trend, which will lull us, and then all of a sudden a sudden spike to the what he is calling the final warning or final warming. And so we're not now true or not, I don't know. I'm not really a scientist, I read scientists, but we're not accustomed to think about this.
A final warming could make us into Mars.
And the issue for us, and Bill, we did, several of us, 250 of us got together and worked on what we call the President's Climate Action Plan. It was handed off to the Obama administration after the election. It was designed for either Republican or Democrat, it didn't matter, but it refocused on the first 100 days of the next U.S. administration. And in that, it's a large, thick document. It's A to Z, 13 major chapters. It's transportation, agriculture, forestry, everything. And in that, the question for the leader of the United States, and this, I mean, to the extent the president is the leader, was what do you tell the public and how do you say it? And this puts you in the old Jack Nicholson movie where Tom Cruise confronts Jack Nicholson about a murder on the base, and where Nicholson's a commandant, and Nicholson goes into this very eloquent statement of defense of what he does to provide freedom for people like this young JAG attorney. And finally he says, you just can't handle the truth. And there's a viewpoint there that we can't handle the truth. On the other side of the question, Winston Churchill, bombs falling on London. Churchill doesn't talk about, hey, this is a great opportunity for urban renewal, and we can whoop the Nazis at a profit. He gets it right. I don't have a thing to offer you but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. And so we recommended that the president give the speech which he hasn't yet given. It'd be the climate equivalent of Roosevelt's Day of Infamy speech. After Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt doesn't come to the public and say, they damaged some of our boats, but No, he said they sunk our fleet, and we're going to have to suck it up and work hard. And the greatest generation was able to do that. Now, climate change is different. It is a long-term thing, but are we capable, with the right leadership, of sucking it up and beginning to see this and respond with what frankly needs to be a sense of wartime urgency? I mean, it is going down to the wire.
Leadership in a democracy requires that there be the leadables.
Followers willing to follow the lead.
And we elect these people, and we drive them, and unfortunately with the polling so predominant, we drive them all day, every day in certain directions. And you address two, what to me are just absolutely critical areas. One's that education, and how we just desperately need to rethink that. And then, of course, what we were talking about earlier, the First Amendment, but the media in general. Right. And we've got to be telling the stories. We've got to be giving young people, but really the whole community, the tool set, the perspective, the dramatization, the reality, in ways that leaders will do what leaders frequently do, which is run to get in front of the parade. The problem is the parade does not seem to have started.
That's a good point. Well, I tell you what we're doing here at Oberlin, if I can. All right, talk
please,
about my
absolutely.
Day job. 10 years ago, actually starting about 14 years ago, we decided
that would be
to
the
create
mid-90s.
An environmental studies center. And we want to do this in very different ways. We want to put this incredible design team together and make this an educational project. So we opened the door to anybody who wanted to be part of the process.
That would be anybody.
So that was people in the city, students, staff, anybody that wanted to come in. And about 250 people came into the process. And the goal was to, as we make a building, to use that as a pedagogical opportunity. I don't like the word pedagogy because it sounds like a foot disease.
Yes, it does.
But, they have pedagogy, but I'm taking something for it. But to make it educational. And that worked beautifully.
A learning experience.
And also did something else. It connected young people age 18, 19, 20, 21. With incredibly accomplished people, 35 up to 80, who were part of this master group of designers around the country. So we're doing the same thing. We're going to do the whole downtown, starting with a 13-acre block that the college owns, and has a very famous art museum, as you know, and a hotel which needs to go or needs radical improvement. But to do the whole block, can you do a block, not just a building, but a block that's powered entirely by sunlight, is a zero discharge block, no waste product leaves it, made out of local materials, and then can you use that as a driver to create a green economy? And then I want to, rough numbers. 10 years to do this project, hopefully sooner, but 1,000 young people, Oberlin students, and high school kids, and kids from Votech School, along with this incredible team of designers we've assembled around the project. So the young people come through the experience, and they're part of rebuilding a town and making it carbon neutral and green and as prosperous as you can make a small town. But they've learned how to roll up their sleeves and get down to work and solve problems and do things in the world. Because the thing I fear about education is we equip young people to know lots and lots of things, but we give them no place. And if you tell people what we've been talking about, that climate change is real and biotic impoverishment is here and oceans are acidifying and all these kinds of things, you raise their anxiety level. And the question is, what do they then do? And it's too easy for them to go eat, drink, and be merry and just wipe their, or ignore it altogether. And so you've got to redirect that energy in a positive way. And you've got to change their Rolodex. So when they leave here, they've got to start. They know lots of important people who are heroes and heroines of this time. If anybody cares to look back on this time, they'll know the names of lots of people who have engaged in this process. These are going to be the leading ecological enlightenment. In the same way you connect Thomas Jefferson and Voltaire with the European Enlightenment. But.
Long before I met you, which is to say more than 15 years ago, I cut out of a magazine David Orr, whom I will quote to himself, "Our goal as educators is to present a sense of hopefulness to students and the competence to act on that belief." That's two very important points. I once saw Joseph Campbell, the great scholar of myth, who said, the way you save the world is through tourism. Now, this was 25 years prior, and he didn't understand how costly that is to the planet with all of the things that go with tourism. If you're not going to save the world with tourism, and his point was clearly that people had to get to know each other so they'd stop killing each other, can we put the future of our planet in the hands of education?
Well, we already have. The people...
For better or worse.
For better or worse. The common denominator of all the leaders and all the people making all the decisions about, the carbon cycle and the nitrogen cycle, those people all went to public school or private school and colleges and universities and graduate schools, and so we already have. And the question is now, can we take back the educational system and make sure that no one leaves ecologically ignorant or incompetent or unable to connect the dots or unable to think about the long term? And the long term is simply, it's that larger, that farther horizon. And if you look at that horizon now, there's a thin white line on that horizon. That's the tsunami that's approaching the shore where we're playing in the sand. And we've got to equip people to see that and understand that and take precaution and precautionary measures before we're inundated with disaster. Connecting the dots, it's no more than systems thinking. That's being able to work laterally across the curriculum and understand, gee whiz, ethics has something to do with ecology here and economics has something to do with both of them. And that's just the seeing the pattern. So we've got, if we were to respond fully as educational institutions to this, it wouldn't be simply that we reduce our carbon emissions. It'd be that we radically alter the way we deliver knowledge and what we call knowledge. And there are lots of things that we need to keep in the curriculum, but you can make a pretty long list of everything that needs to go. And I think that there's, I want to amend that with this comment, that there's nothing inherently trivial, but there are lots of trivial ways to do anything. and so, yeah, Joseph, not Joseph Campbell, the man who wrote Lives of a Cell, Lewis Thomas, Lives of a Cell. What Lewis Thomas did in that wonderful book in such clear, compelling prose was to look at a cell, and through that lens, he could see all the rest of the world. I mean, it was a beautifully, you know, that's what I'm talking about.
I taught a television production course using that book.
Did you? Okay.
And it scared the pants off of the kids taking it, because they said, mm-hmm. Well, what does this have to do with television? We want to know how to focus. And I said, whether or not you focus the camera is utterly irrelevant if you do not look at the larger picture.
Focus your mind.
That's right.
It's the focusing of the mind that's so critical.
And the reason that I did that was that he told me to.
Well, you mentioned
good for you, Bill.
We need some other people on the hook. And you know, you mentioned economics in terms of what you're doing here at Oberlin. Yeah. There's still this powerful argument that is, you know, essentially is driven by economic fundamentalists and you know, assorted right wingers, but is really permeates economic thinking, mm-hmm. that we can't, essentially it comes down to we can't afford to save the world. It's too expensive. Now, put that way, it is manifestly absurd, but essentially, I mean, this, I can't interpret it otherwise. Mm-hmm. What it, and again, you address this. The changes that are required, are, and it's Schumpeter, there are going to be some problems. Exxon, I hope, will suffer. But the economic opportunities are great. But also the role of economics in the overall culture is a mutable condition. Yeah. We've sort of assumed that it has to be this way, that economics has to drive every decision. And your argument, and I think it's a compelling argument, yours and others, is that there are other ways to live a life.
Let's come back right there in just a moment with David Orr. You can think a minute about what all those other ways to live a life might be.
Smart to say, huh?
We'll be back in a minute with David Orr. The college of which he speaks is Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio. Bill Russell and I, Paula Gordon, are here with David Orr. We trust that you'll be with us when the three of us return in a moment.